Hey, ding-dongs, I'm Jamie.
I'm Richard.
And this is Explain It to Jamie, the political comedy podcast in which I, Jamie, a politically innocent but curious young lad, have the complicated political happenings of the world explained to me by my fantastic friend, Richard Lamb.
Yep, fortunately today, we're actually explaining something unbelievably simple.
Yeah.
So we're not going to be here for very long. No explanation necessary.
Yeah.
It's very easy, everyone.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Not
just jokes.
Get ready. Strap in, ladies and gentlemen.
It's complicated.
Yeah, so today,
yes.
What are we learning about, Jamie?
I want to talk about love. No, I don't. I want to talk about Israel and Palestine.
Oh, God. Yeah, great. Don't we all want to talk about Israel and Palestine?
It doesn't seem like it.
No, nobody does.
Seems it's like the second most people start talking about it, they sort of realize they got there by accident, and
yeah.
Like they immediately start backpedaling.
What do you mean? Like, what's my point?
Yeah. So yeah, it seems like it's not a very popular thing to talk about.
No, it's a hairy situation. It's hairy in our culture. It's hairy on the ground for all the people who have to deal with it. It's a deeply complicated and deeply sad and icky thing that's going on over there with no clear solution to the problem.
Mm-hmm. That's what the movie Harry and the Hendersons was based on, right?
I don't know that movie. I'm trying to think. Oh.
John Lithgow and
but I don't
Bigfoot.
Have a yes and for you.
Yeah, John Lithgow's is in this family, and they discover Bigfoot, and he comes home and lives with them, and they're the Hendersons, and he's Harry.
And then like more Bigfoot slowly start moving in, and they're like, "No, you could still live here. We're just also going to have all these Bigfoot living here." And then eventually John Lithgow and his family just have to move out.
And that's exactly right.
Yeah, then I guess it is based on. Okay, I already know there's like emails being written to me, so why don't we just play the theme song as a shield and continue on with this?
Sounds good. Yeah. Defend us, theme song. Go! Whoof. That was a cool
dodge
20 seconds
emails.
Of safety.
Okay, so Jamie, what do you know about the Israel-Palestine conflict?
I know, not much. I know that, like, it was after World War II, I think, maybe the U.S. or the U.N. got together and said we need to find a place for all these Jewish folk, and they cut out a region in the Middle East and put them there. That's caused problems ever since. That's my basic understanding. Feel free to take your time now to call me a dum dum, honk
the
dum dum horn,
yeah,
and send me all the emails.
No, you're not vastly. You're wrong about some of those details, but not all of them.
Right.
Israel has existed as a country since 1948 when it was created by a UN resolution. You are correct about that.
All right.
Basically, the Israel-Palestine conflict, you got to just pick a starting place for it to start talking about it. And so the place that I'll pick is like the late 1890s when this idea kind of came into being and into mainstream Jewish intellectual thought called Zionism.
Right.
You've probably heard this term. Zionism is the notion that Judaism would not just be like a religion or an ethnic group or a cultural group, but would be a nationality, that you needed like a Jewish country, and that was the only way you would ever make Jewish people safe from what was at the time correctly diagnosed to be a very dangerous wave of mounting anti-Semitism across Europe, which is where like 90% of Jewish people lived in the 19th century.
Right. Oh, so, okay. Is that why in the Matrix, the secret lair that they have in the real world is called Zion?
Yeah, there's like, I mean, it's like a, I'm so embarrassing, you guys. I don't know the Bible, but it comes from the Bible or something. I'm so brutal here, guys. This is me being like a total dunce. I don't know the Bible very well.
It's okay. It's in there.
Yeah.
It's also in a Bob Marley song.
So just like how Neo is Jesus, and so Zion like is like a biblical thing.
Yeah.
it also, that's like, I think that's more where it comes from. It's not a reference to Zionism. It's a reference to, I don't know, is Zion like a biblical I'm so embarrassed. I'm like, we're 5 minutes into this and I already have no idea what I'm talking about.
I mean, it must be, in all examples, save for the Bible, because I don't know that one, but in The Matrix and in the...
It's like a safe place. It's like a sanctuary.
Place for people of one, like... In The Matrix,
it's land, human people,
yeah. And in this case, it's anyway, Jewish people.
So like, so Jewish scholars, Jewish thinkers began to realize they needed a homeland. They needed somewhere where they had a political majority and political control, because basically, the Jewish diaspora had kind of spread Jewish people out through Europe,
mm-hmm.
mostly Europe, also some in North America. More would enter North America in the 20th century. And everywhere they had gone, they had sort of assimilated to some extent into the culture of whatever country they were in.
Mm-hmm.
But they were kind of vulnerable, you know, like there were throughout the 19th century, these things called pogroms, which were, you know, like mobs that would occasionally just like storm through and murder Jews, usually in reaction to some sort of imagined slight or even like some sort of real but minor incident between Jews and non-Jews.
Right.
And so there was basically, Jewish people had very few real protections. They were kind of at the mercy of whatever culture they were in. And if that culture happened to be kind of friendly or indifferent to them, they generally got on okay. And if that culture turned hostile, they were super out in the cold. Like, so they didn't have anything to fall back on.
I feel like I know where this is going. Palestine heard this and said,
come over here,
yeah,
guys.
We got you.
We'll voluntarily have you come over here.
Yeah.
No, Palestine, the region of the world known as Palestine was kind of identified to be like an ancestral homeland of the Jews. It's the place where like the Jews were expelled from several thousand years ago, and there was kind of like an intellectual foundation for why that was the place that Jews wanted to settle. It's also near Jerusalem, which has, it's like Jerusalem's in Palestine, which has many of their between Palestine and Jordan, which has many of their holy sites, important Jewish holy sites. I'm not a Zionist expert. There's many reasons that people had to pick this region of the world, and it made sense at the time.
Right.
At the time, it was under British control. It was a British-controlled Arab territory called Palestine. And so Palestine got kind of picked as the region where people would start going to, and Jews began moving there. Jewish people began moving to Palestine from the end of the 19th century kind of until 1948. There was kind of like an influx of Jewish immigration to Palestine, where they were kind of met with this native Arab population who were kind of skeptical of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not because, and this was an interesting thing to sort of learn, like apparently there are multiple narratives from different perspectives on basically every single thing that's ever happened in the history of Israel and Palestine. And so I take a little bit of everything with a grain of salt. That's like a piece of advice I would give.
Right.
I've heard that the conflict between Jews and Arabs in this region is kind of a newer thing. Like before the wave of immigration began in the 19th century, what Jews were there generally coexisted pretty peacefully with their Arab neighbors. Arabs were a huge majority, obviously, so that makes it, you know, a different story.
Right.
Anyway, Jewish people who were kind of seeing essentially the anti-Semitism of Europe getting more and more intense began moving to Palestine. And Palestinians both were basically saw it as an attempt by Britain to colonize them. They were like, they didn't really care that or buy the story that Jewish people were fleeing for their safety. All they saw was all of these non-Arabs coming in who were generally friendly with the British imperial controllers and building their homes and kind of creating these big, you know, new cities and new neighborhoods and changing the demographics of the country. And so there was always armed conflict. That's between
Jewish people and Arab people.
Yeah, once the immigration started, there was tension, and with tension came some amount of armed conflict, which, you know, rose and fell throughout the decades between the start of the 20th century and World War II.
Right.
Like, anytime there's a huge demographic change and people are competing for resources, there's going to be conflict. And then on the other side of things, this kind of, it's hard to not consider this a colonial story, right? It is you know, just by the fact of what literally what's happening, there is an aspect of colonialism to it. These people were living here already, and then there was a big influx of new settlers from a different part of the world. And even though those settlers were coming for a reason that does make a lot of sense, they were displacing people. They were changing the demographics of the country, and that was perceived as a threat and an attack by many of the Arabs, the Palestinian Arabs who already lived there.
Sure, they didn't ask for their world to be changed.
No, exactly.
It was all the same.
So there was tension there. Yeah. Anyway, after World War II, the violence has gotten kind of out of hand. Now, obviously, let me take a pause to say that Israel gets a pretty tough rap in the international community, and for a lot of reasons that make a lot of sense to me. But you can't lose sight of the context and the fact that the reason that people wanted Israel to exist in the first place was that they were worried about how bad the anti-Semitism in Europe was going to get, and they were undeniably correct.
Right.
Like, those people who saw that existential threat to all Jewish people, those people were 100% right about that. Like, there's no doubt that they faced a genocide-level threat to their very survival, and that it required, perhaps, an extreme solution, whatever that would look like.
A final solution.
I didn't see it coming. I walked right into it. And it's also worth saying that, like, there were no innocent countries.
Right.
There were very few pro-Jewish countries at all in the world in this time, including in North America. Like, Canada had a super anti-Semitic government until World War II, and during World War II, you know?
Yeah, that's like an interesting thing. I forget where I was reading. I was reading it, though. It was talking about the American tumbling of like Germany and like the discovery of the concentration camps and stuff like that. And it was saying, you know, we have to stop. The writer of this article was like, I get my back up every time people are like, yeah, America is so great, and like, pro-Jewish people during World War II, that we did all this to save them and this. He's like, that was sort of
an accident.
It was an accident.
Yes.
Like, really, America was like really anti-Semitic.
Oh yeah.
And the whole world was at the time. And it was, yeah, it's sort of a happy accident. Now we can look back and rewrite the narrative and say, like, yeah, you see, we did such a good job. But
we shouldn't do that. Yeah. Like it may seem like it's a bit of an extreme solution to move your entire population to a new country in the Middle East, but where else were they going to go? Mm. Like, you could say, oh, we have all this land in Canada. Why didn't they come here? Many tried. And during World War II, Canada turned away boatloads of Jewish refugees who made it across the Atlantic Ocean to Canada, sent them back to Germany, and they died in the concentration camps. Like, there was not a very warm welcome waiting for them anywhere in particular. And they knew that. Mm. And so they there was a concentrated international movement to move Jewish people to the territory, to Palestine, so that they could form a numerical majority and create a country where they would finally have the safety, or at least they'd be able to be in charge of their own safety, and their safety would be in their hands, and they wouldn't be so vulnerable anymore.
Right.
That context can't be left out of this. Mm-hmm. And again, like I said, they were right. They tried to destroy them. There was a concerted effort to destroy them completely. And so, you know, it's hard to deny them that history. I don't think it's possible or useful to try to pretend that that didn't happen.
Right.
And that wasn't the size of the threat they're facing, and that it wasn't worthy of the response that they had. You know what I mean? So after World War II, the violence in Palestine gets bad. It gets pretty, and the British government basically can't control it and doesn't want to deal with it.
What is it about World War II that makes that happen?
It's just the period. I think there's a lot more Jewish refugees who are trying to resettle in Palestine after this traumatic experience, and all that immigration, I think, inflames tensions. Right. But the violence has gotten so extreme that the British government is like, we can't handle this. We don't want to put this down. We don't want to permanently have a huge military occupation in Palestine. So they go to the United Nations. The United Nations agrees to divide the country in two, into a territory called Israel, which would have a predominantly Jewish population, and a territory called Palestine, which would have mostly an Arab population. And then Israel and Palestine immediately fight a war. Like, immediately fight a war.
Right.
In 1948.
Right. They've been given their, you know, given their jerseys. And
yeah, that's right.
now they're ready to play a league. Yeah.
And Israel smokes Palestine.
Right.
And Israel basically ends up, at the end of the war, Israel had originally been given like 56% of the old territory of Palestine. It now has like 77% of the old territory of Palestine. So like 3/4 of that country are now Israel. Yeah. And that's kind of the first major conflict in Israel, in the history of Israel and Palestine. And it's super important because in the course of seizing all that territory, this basically huge displacement of Palestinians happens. Like, tons of Palestinians get pushed out of their homes. They have to flee to other places, either into the neighboring countries, which are Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, or into other parts of Palestine. And it's about 700,000 people are displaced at this time. And this event is called the Nabka. It's a huge deal for the Palestinians.
How do you spell Nabka?
N-A-B-K-A.
Okay.
The Nabka. It's a huge deal because this only happened in like 1948. It's our grandparents' generation.
Right.
And the people who were displaced by the Nabka are still displaced by the Nabka today. They're descendants. And they still consider themselves to be displaced by the Nabka. This is important. They haven't like found new homes. They're still, many of them are still in refugee camps. They've lived lives in, you know,
right,
refugee
and
neighborhoods.
Born and lived in refugee camps.
The number of people today who are still displaced by the Nabka, I'm doing like air quotes, is like, is in the millions, right?
Wow.
Because it's of their descent, their children, their grandchildren. So, and again, the objective morality of the Nabka has competing interpretations on the Jewish and the Palestinian, the Israeli and the Palestinian sides, because Israelis say, A, that like the Palestinians were told to flee by their leaders so that armies could move in and stuff, and that was a huge part of why so many people were displaced, and they were kind of like ordered out by their own people. And then the Palestinians say, no, the Israelis orchestrated a systematic displacement and destruction of Palestinian civilians' homes so that they could not return, so that they could create a scenario in which they could seize the territory without these people here.
Uh-huh.
And forced displacement of people is like a war crime under the Fourth Geneva Convention, which was only signed in the 70s.
No,
it didn't exist at the time.
That comes after.
Yeah, but it was... Yeah, that's right.
Right, right.
So this is...
So what would happen... So these people are displaced and they're in refugee camps all over the Middle East.
Yeah, most of them end up in...
What would happen if they just, like... I mean, it'd probably be economic destruction, but, like, what would happen if they just put 2 million people back into Palestine?
Like, what do you mean?
If you just, like, said, here you go.
Back into the... Okay, so...
Yeah, yeah.
You mean into the, like, into the territory
the
that's now
Palestine?
Palestine?
Yeah, yeah. Like, brought them...
Well, a lot of them are there.
Right.
But they're not in, like, the traditional places they used to live. The thing about Palestine... Okay, so Palestine. It's hard to do this without looking at a map, but this is a podcast, so I feel like I need to be up to this challenge.
Yeah.
What's called Palestine now is actually two different areas that are not geographically linked. There's no continuous linkage between them in Israel, in the territory of Israel. There's the West Bank, you've heard of this,
yes,
and there's Gaza. They're two different places.
As you're describing this, my brain is remembering what the map of this area of the world looks like. And the Gaza Strip, and then they're separated by...
Israel.
Is
separates them.
Right.
So like the Gaza Strip is in the southwest of Israel, and there's a little tiny border with Egypt, and it's on the Mediterranean coast.
Right.
And then the West Bank is over, it's on the border with like Jordan and Syria, kind of.
Right, right.
And it's in the east side, at the east of Israel. And
it's a country in two parts.
It's a country literally in two parts, and the two parts are very different.
Right.
So most of the Palestinians live in the West Bank. Israel right now occupies the West Bank. It has military control, even though it's technically not part of Israel. It has military control of it. It administers it. It runs the government. It's like a military occupation. Israel has a blockade of Gaza, but it doesn't have troops in there right now, unlike the West Bank. It pulled its troops out in 2005. 2005.
Right. So, I mean, I'm no political scientist, Richard, but it seems like it would be really hard to run a country in two parts like that and to like have sort of a uniform management of
Jamie,
it.
Jamie, you're a genius. Okay, so here, let me just put a bow around the NABCA.
Yeah.
If there's one thing I want us to get out of this podcast, I want to identify these, like, some of the major barriers to peace. Like, in order for peace in the between Israel and Palestine, a few key issues have to be settled. The first serious issue is what's called the right of return, mm-hmm. which is the people who are displaced by the NABCA and all the other Palestinians who have been displaced over the years, but this is the first major displacement, want to go home.
Right.
Or be compensated in some way for being displaced.
Sorry, what did you say this is?
The right of return.
And it's a, this is a agreement, or this is,
well, this
a,
is a term.
Theoretical
this is a,
thing.
A theoretical term of okay. peace. Every time peace talks have happened, the right of return is a major thing on the table.
Right.
Because if you're negotiating for the Palestinians, the Palestinian people, they want to go back to their homes.
Right.
Here's what's sticky about that.
Israeli people live there now.
In many cases, yes. But also, if Israel and Palestine ever, if today we went, waved a magic wand, and Israel and Palestine, boom, it was one country with everyone living there as citizens, Arab people would outnumber Jewish people. And suddenly, if that was a functional democracy, Arab
right.
people could undo the Jewishness of the state, the fact that it was a majority Jewish state.
We look at what happened in Rwanda, where like these people got persecuted for so long, and then their kids came back and
the whole point of Israel existing in the first place was to create a politically majority Jewish state so that Jewish people could have a single state on earth that would protect them. So,
which
that,
I think makes sense.
I think that does make sense.
Yeah.
As we said, they were right. They needed that.
Yeah.
So that's sticky, right? It's sticky already. You could see how that's already sticky. These people want to go home, but what does that look like?
Right.
And in a two-state solution, the two options are a one-state solution where it becomes one country with everybody living in it. The only way that's either, if that happens, either it's not going to be a Jewish country anymore because there's more Arabs than Jewish people living there, or all the Palestinians will be expelled, or most of them will be expelled, and then it will be a majority Jewish state. But either of those two options are horrible.
Do the territories that were emptied by the NABCA, Do those territories happen to connect the West Bank and the Gaza Strip?
I don't think in full, no. I think the two regions were always separated to some extent.
Right.
I don't think it was a there was never land continuity between those two parts, but they were larger.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Let me look.
Because for me, I feel like that's also got to be a priority, is like connecting it from a physical point of view.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe that's a really naive way of looking at geopolitical politics, but like I feel like if your country is connected, it's easier to manage.
Hi, that was a fun edited out digression of me looking at maps to try to make sense of the original borders of Israel. No, the territories did not meet. Also, in the course of clicking through that, we realized that the displacement is actually called the Nakba, not the NABCA.
NABCA.
I had a typo in my notes, you guys. It's very embarrassing for me. First, I said Wilt Chamberlain was the fucking head of the UN, and now here I am just not saying Arab words right.
NABCA
Arabic words
sounds
right.
Like a delicious like egg bread.
Yeah.
I don't know how it is, but it sounds like.
Guys, I'm a dude who Googles. I'm not a Middle Eastern scholar, so I accept my apology. No, the original borders of Palestine never were land; had no continuity over land. They were always divided up by Israel.
Right. Okay. So we were talking about the things that stand in the way of peace. One of which being the right to return.
Yeah. So what do you do with all these people who were displaced?
Yeah. I don't know. Were you asking?
No. You got any ideas? Because they could use them.
I don't know. Put them all in circus lessons.
They need something to cheer them up, that's for sure.
So
that's one of the big outstanding issues. That's one of the earliest barriers to a peace agreement. It has to include something to do with all these Palestinians who were displaced.
Right
So the second thing, and I think one that you sort of hinted at already, was I remember what it was that the two regions of Palestine must be hard to govern,
yeah,
because how do you govern essentially two different non-geographically connected countries?
That are especially separated by a hostile country.
Yeah. So you're right that there's two different Palestinian governments, basically. The Gaza is run by a group called Hamas, mm-hmm. which you've probably heard of. Mm-hmm. And
delicious dip. It goes well with pita.
Yeah. And the West Bank is run by what's called the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO.
Right, a less delicious dip.
Yeah, and originally these were both kind of... These are rebel organizations that were violently opposed to Israeli occupation of their respective territories. The PLO agreed, so they became proponents of a two-state solution eventually. So they accepted that Palestine and Israel would remain divided, and they decided to start being a little bit more cooperative in the sort of early 2000s. And so they've become a less violent organization. Hamas, by contrast, is still a violent anti-Israel group that has control of Gaza. And so the two Palestinian governments disagree seriously about how to negotiate with Israel, how to handle Israel, whether to fight with Israel or not. They don't see eye to eye at all on that. And that's a big problem. And they have fought with each other at the same time as they have fought against Israel violently over this issue.
Here's a question. Is there a problem then? Like, could a problem potentially be solved? This is going to put us on so many fucking lists.
But it's like, okay. Let's just say it.
If they separated as countries. Yeah. You know what I mean? So like Gaza became another thing and West Bank became its own thing. I mean, then it's like, who keeps the baby? Who gets to keep being Palestinian?
Yeah.
And who gets to make up something new? But like, I don't know. I feel like if they can't connect, if they already have two governments, they're effectively working like two different nations.
Yeah.
And if the goal is to, like, we can't solve this thing until they get along and come to the same conclusion, which is made more difficult by an occupation of Israel in the West Bank, and so like therefore like more like Israel influenced political decisions and a disconnect from Gaza,
right?
Would it not be more
a three-state solution?
I've
never heard of that, to be honest. I'm sure somebody has thought of it.
It's
not a part of the mainstream discourse about solutions to the Israel-Palestine problem. My guess is that the Palestinian people don't really want that, because it probably would just divide them they'd get... Part of the problem is that even though the neighboring Arab countries are not necessarily... They're not friendly to Israel. They've been very hostile to Israel in Israel's history. They're not like buds with Palestine. And a lot of the time when Jordan and Syria and Egypt would go to war with Israel, they'd actually just use it as a chance to just take chunks of Palestine. So Palestinians aren't particularly well regarded by their neighbors and aren't super fond of them either. A lot of them are living in refugee camps in their neighboring countries where they're not treated particularly well. And the only country where Palestinian refugees have citizenship rights is in Jordan. In Syria and Egypt, they don't have rights. Citizenship rights at all.
Wow.
So I don't think they want to end up with a country that's as strong as possible. I don't think they'd want to be divided. I think they'd be at big risk of just getting swallowed.
Right. Okay, I understand that. I mean, yeah. I just sort of think of it as, and it's not that this example worked out really well, but like a North Korea, South Korea.
Right.
Thing where you go like we need to separate these things,
right?
Because dealing with one is not the same as dealing with the other.
But that is a problem. It is a problem that they are two different territories with two different governing strategies and two different attitudes towards Israel, one much more hostile than the other.
Yeah, and I mean a lot, like, I don't know, now I'm just selling my own idea, but like the long-term goal could be to unite Palestine, but for now it's to find, you know, peace and stability, and the short-term solution would be just operate as three governments.
Yeah, I mean, it's an option. The problem is that's not the only problem.
Right.
Right? The right of return is a problem.
Sure.
Let's just keep going through the problems.
Got it.
So as you were kind of hinting at too, a huge part of the problem is settlements in the West Bank. Now, again, this is a buzzword I'm sure you've heard, right? Settlements, Israeli settlements, West Bank settlements. What's happened is that even though Israel doesn't technically own the West Bank, it just occupies it. It just has troops there and runs shit and makes people do what it wants. But because it was like an unlawful seizure of territory, it's not recognized as being Israel's. They're technically not allowed to do stuff there, but they have over the last, you know, since 1948 and 1967, when they really seized most of this territory, they've been building towns there. They've been moving people into the West Bank. It's hard to deny that it's not a deliberate strategy to A, push Palestinians out of there and slowly but surely just take it over and make it totally Jewish so that there's no ambiguities about it anymore. And B, at the very least, just make it super messy
right.
to ever create an effective peace deal.
Right. At the very least, it's just a very, very complicated knot that, like, best of luck.
Exactly. Makes it so much weedier, you know, and makes it more likely that Israel will get a bunch more territory, as much territory as possible in a possible peace deal, if there's all these Israeli towns that already exist there full of Israeli settlers.
Right.
Right? And this is it's a traumatic process. It's not like they're going in on some untouched plain and erecting, you know, a pristine village. Like, a lot of the time they demolish Palestinian homes that are already there or force people out using the army and then build Israeli stuff on top of that. It's a conflict-ridden process.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's narratives on both sides about it. For the Palestinians, it's a totally unlawful thing. For the Israelis, they consider it, you know, part of their safety, part of their expansion, just the natural expansion of their country. There's all kinds of justifications. Generally, the settlements are what the international community looks on as a serious violation of human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like one of the main blotches against Israel. The fact that the settlements are happening, it is like, you know, whether it is a forced displacement of people or not, and thus in violation of the Geneva Convention, is a pretty significant thing.
Right.
Israel says it's not. A lot of people say it is.
Netanyahu, he's the dude that runs Israel?
Is he still the prime minister? He was until super recently. I think he is still the prime minister. Yeah, BB. Yeah, he is. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, Benjamin Netanyahu is the prime minister of Israel right now. Yeah.
Okay. I've heard a lot of criticism of him.
Yeah, since the 2000s, like, right-wing governments have been in power in Israel, and he's a more right-wing, hard-line kind of guy.
Mm.
The left-right divide in Israel is similar to the one in North America, similar to Korea also, where, like, the left is generally economically left the way we'd understand them, and they're more in favor of finding a two-state solution. The right is more in favor of a one-state solution in which Jewish people are the majority and the Arabs have been pushed out.
Right.
And this happened in reaction to, in 2005, there was the second, I'm going to make sure I have this word right this time so I don't embarrass myself like I did with Nakba. Pause. I know I wrote this word down. I changed it. So in 2005, there was this thing, or in 2000, there was this thing called, it was the second Intifada, which is like uprising. The first Intifada was in the 1980s, but it was like kind of small scale uprisings of Palestinians against Israel. The one in 2000 was like a serious violent uprising, almost like another war.
Right.
And it really changed the temperature of Israel-Palestine relations. It basically was like, it caused a lot of Israelis to become a lot more hardline and a lot more suspicious, and damaged a lot of the trust between, and the goodwill, whatever was there, between Israel and Palestine.
Right. Here's a question. So I've been you know, there's, I mean, maybe this is just a misremembered figure, but I feel like it's been said that Israel and Palestine have been at war for like 40 years or something like that. And it sounds like they've been at war for like, depending on what, how you define war, a lot longer or like a little bit shorter.
Yeah, I mean, they've been in violent conflict for what I would say is a really long time.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't technically at war before there were two countries because it was like one country.
Right.
Right. A war is the thing that happens between two countries. I mean, part of the other problem is that Palestine doesn't recognize Israel as a country, mm-hmm. right? And Israel doesn't recognize Palestine as a country in some ways. So, so the legal, like, to legal, like, war is a legal thing.
Right.
Right. There's undeniably been armed conflict this whole time with periods of relative calm and periods of violence.
Right. Has Donald Trump been given the opportunity to go over and straighten them out?
Well, you know, the guy who he sent in is his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. That's his, like, project.
Right.
His class project for this term. That's the guy he sent in is, like, you know, 36-year-old failed real estate developer who's married to Ivanka Trump. Like, his job is to bring
fix
peace to the
Israel
Middle East.
And Palestine.
But tons of American presidents have tried to fix the Israel-Palestine situation, and all of them have failed for... Every reason you could think of, including like they were so close to a peace deal in Oslo in 1999 or 2000, and then the Israeli prime minister got assassinated, and then it failed. You know, like
when I was going to say, like, you know, everything we've outlined here with like right of return, the separation of countries, the different governments operating in
right.
Palestine,
and settlements. So settlements,
like those are all clearly make it like tangled and hard to mend. But on top of all of this is like a century of people's brothers, dads,
exactly.
mothers,
it's human.
Sisters
all these humans yeah.
being killed. And like, and you know, we look at what happens with ISIS, where it's just like all these, you know, these 19 to 37 year olds who are still angry about what happened a generation earlier, you know? And
mm-hmm.
and like it's the vicious cycle. And so yep. you're like, oh, you know, on top of all of these political economic issues, there's also just human emotional damage.
100%.
Yeah. I'm sure you've got. Are there more like political, economic things?
There's two major things that we should mention.
Okay.
That are just so one. I just want to again tie up settlements. So any peace agreement has to deal with the West Bank settlements, the Israeli people living in the West Bank, and some of these places are like cities, modern cities, and some of them are like shanty towns that look like frontier towns, and it's generally the wisdom is that Israel will get to keep some of the settlements and give kind of equivalent pieces of land from Israel to Palestine in an eventual peace agreement, right? Mm-hmm. But exactly which ones has never been agreed on.
Right.
That's one of the things that where negotiations have broken down. How many settlements? Which parts do we get in return?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's all a place that this can go to shit.
Right,
So then the last major thing is Jerusalem. Jerusalem is in... the territory of Israel.
Right.
And
God's city, man.
It's the holiest city in both in Judaism and Islam,
yeah.
right? It has many of the most important holy sites for both those religions.
Defended by Orlando Bloom in the City of God.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And where is he these days? That's what I want to know. Why isn't he in there helping people out? Like,
I think he's feuding with Justin Bieber.
Yeah, right.
Like
great.
I actually feel like that. Just that reference ages me a little bit because I'm pretty sure that's like a 3-year-old,
ooh,
like,
yeah,
like pop culture
savage.
Reference.
So Jerusalem was originally under nobody's control. It was like partitioned, like Berlin back mm-hmm. in the day, in the original land agreement between Israel and Palestine, and it was kind of divided in half. Israel had half, and Palestine had half. Part of the problem was that one of the most sacred sites in Judaism was in the Muslim half, and they didn't let Jewish people pray there. There's also in the same neighborhood two important Muslim sites, all next to each other.
Right. Yeah.
So, in 1967, which I briefly mentioned, but I'll just say, in 1967 there was this thing called the Six-Day War, where Israel struck first and just took a shitload more territory from all of its neighbors.
Right.
They claimed this was because they knew they were about to get attacked in return, so they did a preemptive strike. And one of the things they did was seize Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is pretty much all under Israeli control now. And Israel has been moving Jewish people there in a lot of ways, so that there's a much larger Jewish population there than there used to be. And now any peace deal has to deal with Jerusalem, because access to the holy sites in Jerusalem is like no one's going to give that up. No Palestinian leader could walk away from a deal where they agreed that, like, you know, Israel could just control Jerusalem and have any kind of credibility with their people. There would be rage about that, right? And ditto with any Israeli leader. An Israeli leader can't surrender Jerusalem to the Palestinians.
Right. There's too much stakes locked up in those temples and mosques.
Yeah. It's they're spiritual sites for these people. Yeah. They have great meaning. And there's, like you said, generations of ill feelings, violence, and tragedy on both sides with regards to this.
Yeah.
And so whatever, any peace agreement has to somehow share Jerusalem or share access to Jerusalem with both of these populations. And so far, none have successfully figured that out.
Right.
So we've got, with the right of return of Palestinians, we've got the settlements in the West Bank, who gets to keep them and what other territories end up going to Palestine. We've got, how do we split Jerusalem evenly between all these people? And we've got the fact that half the Palestinians want a violent conflict with Israel and half of them don't.
Woo!
And that's why this is so fucking complicated.
Right. Wow. Wow. And yeah, the level of compromise that it would require is almost unfathomable.
You would need a country of Gandhis. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
it feels like you just want... It's impossible to expect people to just get over generations of trauma. And yeah. I include everybody in this because, like I said, Israel has perpetuated a lot of what is in the modern age considered to be like the forced resettlement of people, you know, criminal illegal acts against the Palestinians. They're occupying their territories. They have an extremely restricted movement. They have a pretty poor quality of life in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all happening. And that's all stuff that the Israeli government is doing in many ways. It's, you know, to push them out. It's to create a majority Jewish state. But again, like I said, they were right. They almost all got killed. People tried.
Yeah.
You can never take that away.
And this sort of leads me to, this is maybe a big scary question, but like, mm-hmm. what our first reference in this podcast was, you know, people are very tight-lipped about what they say and when they say it about Israel. Why is there... and then the conflict. Why is there this nervousness to talk about it with any sort of criticism? I'm not saying
from my perspective,
point of view of like everyone should be criticizing Israel because I myself am fucking afraid to say that out loud.
Yeah,
but like, what does that come from?
I think it's that there has been a concerted effort among the shittier pro-Israel people in North America, there's been a concerted effort to blur the lines between criticism of Israel and anti-Semitism.
Right.
Right? Like, any rational human being would think that you are able to criticize the actions of a nation state and not reflect on the like inherent human worth of the humans who live there.
Right.
I guess I would even be willing to just gently tip the hat and concede that like Zionism as a concept says that Jews should have a safe and political homeland. And if you're threatening or criticizing the practical measures they need to take to do that in the real world, I guess I could see how if this was your life and your people and, you know, you were the ones, your family survived the Holocaust, your family faced a complete genocidal threat, you would be kind of pissed at everyone for quibbling with you about what you needed to find your safety. I actually really do understand how that would get fucking old.
Sure. But yeah, I get that.
At the same time, yeah, it's just kind of it's hard because it's a deeply emotional thing. It's not, again, I haven't said this yet. I'm obviously not Jewish. I've spoken to many Jewish people over the years from all kinds of different political leanings about this kind of thing, and they have radically different views on it. You know, they're a diverse group of people with very diverse political leanings and very diverse attitudes about how exactly they should go about securing their homeland. And it's kind of like an armchair quarterback thing, maybe at the end of the day, to say, yes, I think you should have a homeland, but you should not see to your safety. You're doing too much. You're being too aggressive. You're doing too much harm in creating your homeland. I get how that would seem just kind of easy for people to say at best and anti-Semitic at worst, because it's like you're saying essentially that you want to undermine their security. And like we said, there's a number of situations in which Israel could cease to exist as a Jewish state, and then it would kind of be destroyed, you know, like that safety would be destroyed. And I could see how you can make the leap to think that that was anti-Semitic. I don't, and I think there are a shitload of anti-Semitic humans out there also.
For sure. Like, and they're probably manipulating the good sides of that argument.
Yeah. Anti-Semitism's fucking real.
Right.
But as like for people like you and I who are not anti-Semitic people, like we do not take any issue with Judaism or the inherent humanity of Jewish people or the right of Jewish people to self-determine. It is sticky because anti-Semitism is so real and has such a violent history and such an ugly history. You don't want to perpetuate it, but you also don't want to not call a human rights violation a human rights violation. Like, these people's homes are being destroyed. They are being pushed out. They have suffered a lot, just as you have. That's just part of what makes it so icky to talk about.
Yeah.
And it's hard to mince words about it.
It's also, you know? It's also, I imagine, like, as I've discovered, it's a very complicated issue. And so I don't think I would be able to speak very confidently about even the stuff that's been like that we talked about today. I feel like it requires a great deal of understanding and research to even sort of carry a surface level conversation around it.
Absolutely.
And so I feel like that's also probably contributing to fear of, you know, just not knowing what I don't know.
Yeah,
you know,
100%.
And not being 100% confident in my ability to speak clearly and not come off like an asshole. And like, you know, as you and I were talking about earlier, not come off like with a different identity, labeled identity than I did before I entered the conversation, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I can't imagine what it must be like to have this be your life, you know, like to have it be your real, to have it be your family. To have it be something tied up for real for you. You know, it must be infuriating to be Palestinian and to know that your people are suffering and to feel powerless to stop it. And it must be infuriating to be Israeli and, you know, feel like everyone wants you to exist, but not on the terms that you are existing on. You know what I mean? Which are maybe the necessary terms for it to have existed for this long as a country. Like, it's just a mess. Like, it is messy. And that's sort of a reality about it. I think it's doubly hard for a Canadian to find their way into this because it is a colonial story. Like, it is a story of colonialism, the way we have it now. It's just all accelerated into the second half of the 20th century.
Yeah.
Right.
I was going to say, this is like, when we were talking about occupied land and right of return and things like that, I was like, oh, these are all questions and conversations that are being pushed for First Nations people,
yeah,
with the Canadian government, and it's just the Israel-Palestine thing seems a bit further along and a bit more, obviously a bit more aggressive. But
well, and like, let me just say too, and I'm not drawing a direct parallel here, but can you imagine if the entire history of Canada's oppression of Indigenous people had happened in the period since there was television?
Right.
Like, no, like, I think Canada would be facing a very different kind of Indigenous presence, mm-hmm. a much angrier and more and more violent, honestly, Indigenous presence, if this had all happened since our grandparents were alive, if they had been subjugated and occupied and oppressed, and it hadn't happened starting in the 1700s, you know, when information disseminated in a very different way from it does now.
Yeah, and it's all about everything is passed on by the victor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, yeah.
Like, that would be a different story. And it's hard as a Canadian who's reckoning with reconciliation and the history of Canada's colonial violence here to not look over at Israel and Palestine and think, like, you, there is a cycle of colonial violence being perpetuated there. Certainly, just structurally, the model looks like that. And how can you break it, break the cycle in a way that allows Israel to keep existing as a Jewish state, which I think is a good thing that's worth fighting for, but without the oppression, without the colonialism? I don't know. It's a mess.
Right.
It's hard for me to say.
Well, maybe we'll have a second Israel-Palestine episode in a couple weeks when you and I have time to mull this over.
We'll figure this out.
And come up with the perfect answers that everybody can understand, and we'll flower over the world like a beautiful perfume, sending everyone into instant orgasm and ecstasy. And
that's all they need.
Yeah, yeah.
They all just need some Ode to Jamie. Yeah, that's right. We got this for you guys. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Should we call it there?
Let's call it there. This has been very interesting. I've been excited for this topic for a long time. I think because it makes me nervous.
Yeah. I hope I didn't commit any hate crimes by explaining any of this. But if I did, you know, shoot me an email. We'll talk about it next time.
Again, I think like disagreement is a natural process that should be sacred.
Yeah, right.
And like, and it should, you know, the outrage machine, I think, is just, we just need to take a bit more time to like say you have a different opinion, or maybe you misspoke, or whatever it is, but like give allowances and engage in topics from a point of not knowing, and from a point of explain it to me. Maybe in explaining, you'll see a flaw in your logic, or I'll learn something new about your point of view.
That's the hope.
So that being said, do send Richard your hate mail.
Yeah, you can reach me at antisemiticrick@gmail.com.
If you like this episode, please share it with your friends and family alike. If you didn't, keep it to yourself. No one likes a whiner.
Lock that mouth lock.
If you have any like ideas for topics, we love hearing those from you guys.
We do.
Get at us. We're on Facebook. Explain it to Jamie. We're on Twitter @explainjamie.
Instagram.
Pinterest. Gmail. Explainitojamie@gmail.com. We're all over the internet. Just give us a Google. Hop on iTunes, give us a rating, give us a review.
Do it all.
You know, that's at this current point in time, we are not asking for money. We're asking for love and support and input. So, you know, if you're some of the lucky few who are if you are some of the lucky few...
I'll edit this out.
Yeah. If you are some of the lucky few who are... fucking God damn it!
Jamie, what's happening to you?
If you are some of the lucky few that are setting the trend in listening to Explain to Jamie, we are not asking for money at this time. We are asking for your input and for your love. So please help us out.
Yeah.
It helps a great deal.
Until next time.
I,
Jamie,
Richard, explain it to Jamie.